With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's a hellish nightmare. It's time for Must Have Seen TV, the podcast dedicated to the sitcoms of the 20th century from I Love Lucy to News Radio. I'm your TV guy, Brett White, and I'm also a reporter and producer for Decider.com, and welcome to part 12 of the quarantine era of the podcast, which means you're just going to get unfiltered audio of talking of people with no clips and no music and nothing special, because I'm just going to get this stuff out to you as fast as possible. You're going to like it, and you're going to love it, and I appreciate you listening. This week, I am joined by returning guest superstars of the podcast, Dan Chamberlain.
Bijou.
Woo! And Nat Towson.
Hello, cowabunga.
Radical, radical. Wait, so are we in three different boroughs?
I'm in Brooklyn.
So Brooklyn and Queens. We're the BQE going on right here. Quarantined in three apartments in two boroughs. How's it going? How's your quarantine times?
Just tearing up at the Wonder Years.
Oh, yeah. I almost started crying at this.
It put me in a very weird mood this episode. It's like for some reason in my brain, I had compartmentalized the show as a little more maudlin and easy to dismiss for that reason. And this actually was quite melancholy and made me very kind of really sad. Yeah.
Are y'all finding that you are crying or getting emotional at things that should not be doing the trick for you, but in these circumstances?
Yeah, I think we've all got probably a little less emotional energy to go around right now. And that includes the energy that is usually spent regulating your emotions. So I think sometimes it's maybe not that something doesn't deserve it, but that your response might be disproportionate or unusually proportioned.
Yeah, I've been just losing it. I've been having the opposite, just cackling nonstop at the stupidest things. There's this show coming out on Netflix called Sweet Magnolias, which is exactly as Southern and melodramatic as that sounds. And I was reading the Wikipedia page, and I found out that both the showrunner is Cheryl Anderson, and the author is Cheryl Woods. And just the thought in my head of this show comes from two Cheryls.
From the Cheryls who brought you Wedding Crashers.
It just made me lose my mind, just cackling hysterically at the idea of two Cheryls teaming up to bring you Sweet Magnolias. And that's not funny. That's not...
They finally buried the hatchet.
Yeah, the Cheryls are back.
Put the blood feud to rest, and now they're unstoppable.
In terms
there
of,
can
like,
now be two.
Emotional control stuff, the one I can't wrap my head around is, I feel like I saw so many guys do, the head shave on, day three into quarantine. Yeah. It's you guys, it's been 72 hours, and you're I better start drinking my own piss. save some. We're going to be here for a while.
How'd your fingernails get so long? It's only been 4 days.
My God. Yeah. You should cash in those, performative breakdown chips a little early, man.
Seriously.
Yeah, what's left? There's nowhere to go but, back up. Or to scarier places. I am not cutting my hair. I am figuring out how to wear it long.
Have you not had a single haircut since the quarantine began?
I did look out that I went to the barber and he gave me the shortest haircut I've had in a long time. Without me knowing, I didn't know what I was asking for when I said, oh, yeah, sure, that guard is fine. And it was you could basically see the skin on the side.
Yeah, because yours still looks
of...
short on the sides. Yours looks done deliberately short on the sides.
So, I think maybe my barber knew what was coming. I've still been tipping him during the quarantine.
I'm sorry. So. Are you theorizing that your barber gave you a short haircut because he predicted the COVID outbreak?
Yeah, he was taking care of me. He knows, hey man, I'm not going to see you for a while. But
I feel like we should look into that guy if that's the case. We're not really paying enough attention to
he's
your barber.
He's a barber truther. I love it.
That's my gig. But also, this week we're going to be traveling to February 1st, 1989. Three Fugitives ruled the box office, and When I'm With You by Sheriff topped the charts. And ABC aired the Wonder Years episode Pottery Will Get You Nowhere. Dan and Nat, you must have seen Pottery Will Get You Nowhere before today.
Wait, what is Three Fugitives?
See, this is the first time that I don't know what the song or
target.
The movie is.
Is that Trouble in Paradise are you referring to? It sounds like... The plot of Trouble in Paradise.
I looked it up, and Three Fugitives, I think, stars Nick Nolte and Martin Short, and it is a comedy, like, cop crime movie. I don't know who the third fugitive is, because they're just the two leads. And then James Earl Jones plays the cop that I assume is after them. Modest success. I think it made, like, $45 million at the box office on a budget of significantly less. But time has not... I don't know what this... When I'm With You by Sheriff?
Sheriff. I'm confusing Sheriff with Warrant. And
yes.
You see why.
Yeah, the Sheriff has a warrant. They should have toured together.
Both have double R's in the middle of the word, you know?
Yeah, so I was expecting to know all this in 1989, but nope, no memory. What is y'all's history with the Wonder Years, and were you familiar with the emotional rawness that we were getting into?
I watched this show growing up. My mom liked it, so I was allowed to watch it, even though it gets like fairly serious or takes on some fairly serious issues in certain episodes. And it has this sort of emotionally charged place in my mind because I think for my mom, it was watching it and, you know, looking at parallels to her own childhood.
Yeah.
So she was watching this. And the show, I mean, it's so steeped in nostalgia in a way that doesn't really feel exploitative, but they're like, you know, there's obviously the opening credits, the sort of home movie aesthetic to the whole thing. There's the, it's being told in, you know, retrospective narration from, like looking back on those, it's literally called The Wonder Years. Like it's about losing innocence. Like the whole arc of the show is about that. So I think it was really emotionally charged for my mom. And then like, I think I have a sort of secondhand version of that, like filtering that through her experience. And then that is now a childhood memory for me watching that show. So I have these like sort of distant Wonder Year memories of watching The Wonder Years with my mom.
Dan, did you grow up?
I had a similar relationship with the show. Television was very metered in our home, this for some reason or another was deemed, particularly like a primetime network show, is shocking to me that this was deemed because I was aware of other this is an okay show that we're absolutely not allowed. This was a permitted show, though I don't recall it being appointment viewing, and I feel like it may have at some point in its run aired on Sunday nights, which may have contributed to our being allowed to watch it. School nights were pretty, like, even though Sunday is a school night, when you're a kid, it's like, oh, it's not a school night, I didn't have school today. Like, you still wring a little weekend out of that night, you know?
I'm so glad that my parents, I guess I got good grades, so they never had to take away my television. Like, I never made them need to punish me or be like, well, you need to focus on your studying. Because I watched maybe 8 to 10 hours of television a day as a child, even with going to school.
No, that would not have been permitted. And Brett, I think it's funny that you frame it as that Dan and I were being punished.
It sounds like punishment to me.
We weren't allowed to watch 8 to 10 hours of television at night, so clearly we had done something wrong to lead
How
to that.
Did the state ever get involved? I mean, really?
The torture.
I think it was more of a parenting decision, I have to say.
I would go up to my room, and I would just watch television and not talk to anyone. That's normal and healthy.
And it's funny you said that thing about, like, you know, the sort of like the the recursive nostalgia of this, because even before starting this episode, I probably haven't watched an episode of The Wonder Years since the, you know, early 90s, or, you know, I think it ran in, I want to say this was on in reruns on Nick and I, some cable, yeah. I have a very low tolerance for rose-colored boomer nostalgia, Forrest Gump stuff, this like, wow, mm-hmm. man, the 60s stuff. And what struck me about this was, even though there were, what was it, the Detroit riots in the background we saw for a second, like, even though they alluded to this, the sort of cult, like what was happening in the culture, I was impressed by how accurately it did, like, nail that specific feeling of child. This may sound odd, and it reminded me of Malcolm in the Middle in a weird way.
Oh, yeah.
A very, very different show, but nailing a very specific, like, look, like, when you're, there's a powerlessness to being a child.
Yeah. So,
like, you know, of just this, like, this sort of perpetual muddling through it of, like, we're all just, well, we're all in this situation and we can observe it and make the best of it or whatever. And it had a lot more of that than I anticipated or remembered.
Yeah, yeah, and not to jump ahead, but just sort of that tenseness of being a child in an environment that you cannot control, and your parents have so much power, and so, like, when one of them is angry or they're angry with each other, you are just on, you know, high alert, walking on eggshells, like, constantly.
Yeah.
And, like, it definitely captures that feeling. I felt very tense watching certain parts of this episode.
Lots of feelings.
Yeah, it really,
for some reason, was not
feeling very well.
We didn't watch it when I was a kid, which is wild. Like, I was watching so much television as a child, but I did not watch Wonder Years.
I don't know why.
But I will say that even without watching Wonder Years, the show was so embedded in pop culture that, like, I knew every single character on site and actor without ever watching an episode as a kid. And I don't know where I was seeing them, like, just commercials, or like commercials for the show, or it coming on before or after things I was watching. But, like,
I had a bizarre sense memory while watching this episode. I remember we had very close neighbors, both in age and, you know, we could get to their house through the woods. So, like, we would, my brothers and I would hang out with these neighbor brothers often. And I forget the specifics of the situation, but, like, something had happened where there was some impact and someone was, like, crying. There was some break. And I remember it, like, trying to, like, emotionally reason with, like, a large group of children of what was going on. My being a child as well at the time. And one of these neighbor kids saying to me, "Dan, you watch too much Kevin." And that's what he was referring to, The Wonder Years, like, as, like, a hokey thing. He was like, "Dan, you watch too much Kevin," because I had, like, made some gesture to, like, make peace amongst a bunch of, like, squabbling peers as, like, a child.
I did
like a fictional character right now.
I always called Life Goes On Corky, which I also feel like everyone did. For some reason, Life Goes On, I did watch. Did not watch Wonder Years, but watched Life Goes On. Two Beatles songs.
I would believe if they were both in the same. They seem. And Life Goes On was ABC as well. Like, that's a great programming block. It would absolutely make sense if they were paired together, you know.
So this week on Must Have Seen TV, we will be talking about the Wonder Years episode "Pottery Will Get You Nowhere." It is the sixth episode of season two, and was written by Matthew Carlson and directed by Daniel Stern. Here's how Hulu describes the episode. Unbeknownst to the family, Norma has begun taking a pottery class. They find out when she brings home her first project for family approval. Nat and Dan, how accurate is that description?
That's
surface appraisal of what's happening in this episode.
It's not what I would say, like, the emotional thrust of the episode is exactly.
The episode, I realized, like, halfway through, has at least two, it's juggling two metaphors at once, because, like, the relationship of the parents is fragile, like the pottery, like, they're watching it break, and there's all this, like, earthquake tectonic plate talk at school. Like,
well, they're also sort of, yeah, they're going, "Your society and your country could crumble right now." There's even that part where they're in the class with Ben Stein, who, you know, it nails that role and also helped Richard Nixon. So, you know, kind of evens out.
This was Ben Stein's first episode, I read on Wikipedia. This is the first appearance. The second season is this episode is the first appearance of Ben Stein's character on this show.
Oh, wow.
I did not know that.
History.
I was going to say there was a part where Ben Stein is talking to them about natural disasters, and he says, oh, you think this can't happen at home? Well, it happened in Missouri in 1811, and they have – I don't know that there should be footage from 1811, but seems as if that predates photography. But they have images at least from this huge earthquake, and then it cuts to the scene where the dad knocks the mug off of the table and it shatters. So it's drawing this parallel between the sort of two running, the working, the pottery in the home, and then the macro metaphor of the natural disasters in their sort of crumbling society. It's a lot
Things
going on
break.
In 23 episodes, a 23 minute episode.
Yeah, that hit me. I was like, oh my God, they're doing, and also the fact that they aren't underlining it. Like they never once say, like the narration is never like, you know what? I guess earthquakes sometimes don't move. Like, they never say, like, our relationship was just as fragile as the ceramic pottery. Like,
no. He never. I really think they do a good job of not laying it on thick with the voiceover. The only part was that one line at the very end during the tracking shot where it's like, it just goes to show that you grab on and sometimes you got to grab and hold on to whatever you can grab on to. It's like, wait, what? it felt a little out of tone for the rest of the episode.
Tears were streaming down my face, so I let it slide.
I don't want to jump. I'm jumping around too much.
So the episode opens. Every episode opens with the iconic opening credits, which just like hit me like a sledgehammer of nostalgia. Of just like, because I definitely know those opening credits.
Real quick, this is not the Joe Cocker version.
No,
Joe Cocker
they don't have the music rights.
This is a knockoff music version.
It's a gravelly voiced man singing that song, but that, like,
see,
that's not
that
Joe
for
Cocker.
Me. Yeah, I think I had a different experience than the nostalgic tearjerker experience of the credits I was expecting, because that had like a uncanny valley unfamiliarity to me, where I was like, no, like my brain wants to recognize this so badly, and it's not quite the right thing.
Truly, what would we do if he sang out of tune? I mean,
he sang with a different voice.
Yeah, I'm learning now. I'm finally getting the answer to that question.
But then, like, it was hard to take notes of the episode because usually the sitcoms I do are always shot on a stage. It's very linear storytelling. And if you're going before the 80s, there's only an A story and that is it. Like, they aren't even doing B's and C's. Like, it is a very linear thing. But Wonder Years is no laugh track. It is shot like single cam, like a film, on film. And therefore, like, keeping track of, like, all the threads, because they really do an interesting job of, like, the beginning of it is a montage of Kevin talking about his parents, and we're seeing them, like, driving and getting lost and shopping for tiles and just, like, all that stuff that you could not do on stage.
The other thing this first act really, like, that really jumped out to me was, of course, there's the famous, like, internet meme of, like, you know, sitcoms without laughter, you know, or they, like, you know, Friends without laughter. I've also seen a cut go around of, like, hey, the Wonder Years without narration.
Yeah.
And what was shooting this? Like, I wonder if, like, if the director was on set, like, reading the narration or just, like, nudging those, like, reactions, because an enormous amount of this show is dialogue free. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of physical work. That opening.
Would this be easier or hard? Is that easier or harder to shoot? Not having to worry about saying lines, but just the director be like, okay, and now they're looking at tile, you react like this.
Oh, that's a good point. They're probably MOS for the entire opening montage, right? Like, when they're choosing the tiles at the store, and he's setting up his parents' relationship.
Yeah.
Did that remind either of you at all of, I mean, it's maybe an obvious comparison, but A Christmas Story? Sort of the description of the power dynamics in his parents' relationship.
I almost wrote that down. Like, I got such Christmas Story vibes from this, and then I realized, oh, that's probably the entire series is Christmas Story vibes.
To some degree, but I really think specifically that montage where he's explaining, I mean, and this happens in a number of episodes, explaining, like, a convention of their household, like, that was a thing that upon rewatching this, I was struck by is the degree to which the show is really, like, deconstructing the minutiae of this 1960s suburban family dynamics. And he has, like, this complete understanding of how this power structure, this arbitrary power structure exists, like, within the containment bubble of their home. It's so fascinating, like, the time that is taken to tease apart and deconstruct every interaction, and how he's like color commentating his parents' relationship at a certain point.
And it's Daniel Stern doing the narration, who is also directing this episode.
Right.
That's why. I mean, like, good job, Daniel Stern. Right. I don't really think of him as a director. And this is also pre Harry and Marv. So.
Right. Yeah. I don't think he directed in season one. I could be wrong about that.
I also, I wanted to bring up, oh God, what was I going to bring up? This is what I don't edit anything out anymore. There's no editing. I'll just say
something that you would edit out.
No, well, I guess, but that's just going to make me do work. No, I was just going to say blanket note. Now that I am an adult gay man, I recognize the dad is hot, right?
Dan Loria?
Yeah. I was like, oh, he is very handsome. He looks like Beast. Like, he looks like what an artist should draw Beast to look like.
Yeah, he's a hefty man, but
yeah,
he's sort of got a Bob Bob Hoskins energy, don't you think?
Big Bob Hoskins energy. When I was watching
strong
this, I was like, oh my God, I bet he's like 34 or something. Because when you go back and watch this stuff and you realize how old the people are, you always feel insane. And I looked it up and he's 42 in this episode. So okay. I feel I'm not having a panic about that.
That's a decent, I would imagine that dad to be a few years older than that at most, I think.
Yeah. So what is the deal with Kevin's other siblings? So like there's the older brother who's a doofus.
He was so much funnier than I remembered. When I watched this show as a kid, I hated that character. And I think because he was just a bully and I genuinely like didn't like him. And now when I'm watching it, like that actor is doing such a good job. He's so funny. And like every time they cut to him, he's doing something like a sight gag that nails it in a single shot. I don't remember him being a funny character at all. I remember him being like a very frustrating antagonist.
He also is like, I don't know, in this episode, having this being the only episode of the show I've seen in like probably, you know, 25 years or so, it feels like the older brother is living up to the father's ideals past the point that the father still has those ideals. Like he's like, or like, you know, he's like checking boxes of like, hey, I'm being the son my dad wants, even though like, I feel like at this point in his life, his father is like given up on like wanting that sort of thing out of his sons or his life.
Now the daughter, I did not remember her being a character.
Olivia Dabo. She was a hippie on the show. She was, okay. That was her big thing. She went and protested and stuff. She also had, she has a couple other big TV roles. She was the, lesbian professor on Party of Five who Neve Campbell hooks up with. She had some character on Clone Wars who
now we're talking.
Whose voice appears in the montage at the end of Rise of Skywalker,
oh,
too.
Oh, hell yeah.
So Olivia Dabo has a credit in Rise of Skywalker.
So I am upset that Danica McKellar is not in this episode, and I can't talk about her amazing run of Hallmark Christmas movies that she's been on for the past decade.
And yet somehow you have.
What do you got? A lot of shit where it's like, I woke up and I was living in a snow globe. Like that sort
I think
of
she was in. She was in Christmas at Dollywood last year. Christmas at Dollywood was a good one. I liked it.
What's the plot of Christmas at Dollywood?
They need someone to make the tree lights be really good, and they bring her in to plan the event. And her mom's like, "Well, don't you want to stay here and like write your children's books in Tennessee instead of going back to New York City?" And then she ultimately, spoiler, she stays in Tennessee. She meets a fella
who
doesn't know how to button the buttons on his collar. Drove me crazy.
Just goes to show, don't move to New York. There's no dreams to be had.
No, I mean, hey, now who's laughing? We're all stuck in here. We're going to be here forever.
It's true. Whoever went to Dollywood saved the lights in Dollywood or whatever the plot of that movie was, she's probably saving a lot on rent right now.
Yeah, she's not even wearing a mask. It's Tennessee. They don't care.
The older sister, I remember watching the show as a kid, and then at one point the older sister showed up, and I was like, who is this? And I think my mom said, it's his big sister. She kind of drops out, I think, at some point. Like, it's implied that she's a hippie. She stops going... I mean, I think there's an episode about it. She stops going to school for a while, and she's just, like, going and, like, sitting in a field with a bunch of hippies every day. And there's, there's like, a little while where she starts to let Kevin come into her room, and then she takes him out with him with her one day, I think. And then he does something uncool at some point, and a lot of that gets revoked. And so I think she's absent from a lot of the series.
As a teen girl would be. They got things going on.
I was surprised to see her be that much of this episode.
Yeah, she's in it. She gets into it, and it's really good. The next scene is at the school, and we get the first of the Ben Stein lecture scenes, and we introduce the volcano, earthquakes, and Paul, who is not Marilyn Manson.
But he still got his ribs removed so he could suck his own dick.
He's not Marilyn Manson, but he did date Rose McGowan, and
yeah.
He's in Bowling for Columbine, I believe. Yeah.
But he has this anxiety freak out where he just completely like loses it. And watching that in this situation that we're in right now, I'm like, yeah, Paul, I feel ya. Like, I feel all that anxiety.
Yeah, he's definitely worrying about the wrong thing, but the impending doom that they're basically in throughout the episode, the teacher keeps showing them, you know, this is the way that the world will end, you know, the galaxy will collapse. This is how, you know, a society
Earth is
going to
look like a wiener dog.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The oceans are going to overtake our board, you know, and eventually it gets to Paul. And yeah, I gotta say, all of that doomsday proselytizing. Oh, let me take that again. Doomsday. Proselyte. No, let me take it again. Hold on. Doomsday yelling.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry.
Crazy talk. Just crazy talk.
No, but I think like the character of Paul feeling as if he's not wrong for believing in one of these far off but plausible doomsday scenarios is scary. Like the fact that no one will listen to him, like, is, like you said, ultimately very relatable right now.
Yeah. Well, like they boil it down to, I don't want change. Why does the earth have to change? Which that line, I literally was, I think saying that, freaking out to my husband over the weekend. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to imagine a world where we can't go to fucking movie theaters ever again.
Yeah, like, and I think it sets so well against... I mean, I think that's one of the successes of the whole series is it's this society on the brink of a sort of paradigm shift. And it's funny, yeah, we catch like the glimpse of the riots. I think there's like an ironic cut there where they're like...
It's right there, yeah.
Nothing else goes wrong or something like that, and then it cuts to the riots. But yeah, it's framed so well against like the just sort of like very quiet backdrop of social change. They never textually, even in the voiceover, he never mentions it.
After that, we get the introduction of the bowl. We get to the dinner scene.
Oh yeah.
And Norma's come home. She's got a bowl. And she keeps like nudging, trying to get people to...
It's like cruelty, though, what the father is doing. Don't you think? Like,
what? Yeah, and I also like the episode. So, like, they all finally, after she, like, mentions the bowl, which has the meatballs, and she mentions it a lot, they finally, like, say, like, oh, you made this great, cool. And she's like, I'm taking pottery classes. And all she wants is just something from Jack, her husband, to say anything. He won't say anything. Why? The show never once underlines why he isn't saying anything, which I think is very daring and mature, because they could have done the Full House thing of at the end and him being like, well, you know, I just didn't want you. I just felt all of a sudden I wasn't important in your life anymore. And I was just, you know, jealous you might not need. Like, they don't do that. They leave it very vague.
I agree with that being a very, like, mature storytelling choice. And I feel like, I think that is what colored in what I sort of began our talk with, that the feeling of like, powerlessness as a child, mm-hmm. that because there is just part of this story that you don't know and may never know, quite frankly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there is a reason and you don't know it because you're little and you're only getting part of the story. And there will maybe always sort of be some little part of your brain that's like, why the fuck was Dad always mad when we were little? You know what I mean?
And you never got to ask Dad because he died of a heart attack. I know that. Wait, that's how it ends, right? With like the montage of like where they all end up?
Yeah.
Or is that also on Roseanne? Because that also happens to Dan on Roseanne.
You're thinking Six Feet Under.
He does die of a heart attack, and the older brother takes over the furniture store.
God, that's wild. Yeah. But they did that to both Roseanne to Dan Connor and this guy. Anyway.
I know you don't edit it out, but that's a pretty major spoiler if your listeners are not Wonder Years watching.
This show is 30 years old.
Yeah, but I mean,
it doesn't happen in the context of, well, you know what? Hey, if Mia Wonder Years Dum Dum knows it.
Fair enough.
Boom, boom. There you go.
Yeah, I don't know what isn't a big spoiler. Sorry, go ahead.
then we get like the cut to the next scene where like the dad is looking for his stupid mug.
Right.
What was it like? Had fish on it and like welcome to Missouri
some mug from a vacation that he bought at a rest stop or something.
Yeah, and he loses his mind over it, and Norma's like, well, I made you this mug because maybe you won't like be easier for to hold or something. And then it's just like this tense kind of adult fight. Like all the fights between them were like. Real.
Yeah, well, he sets it up. They never openly disagree. Like, when they're arguing like, no, I'll do it. No, don't, like, they're yeah. both being extremely passive aggressive. Like, no, I'll take care of it. No. If you're going to do it, I'll take care of it. And it makes it so much more tense because no one says what they're feeling. And just to the point that you and Dan were just making, I think it is really interesting. They never fully explain. I mean, like, let's break it down if we can. The dad.
Yeah.
I guess he feels threatened that his wife has a new interest, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And he doesn't know how to express that. And I think he doesn't like the new mug. And but this, you know, the pottery resentment has already started by this point. Like the new mug is kind of gaudy.
Well, and also everything she makes, she makes that bowl that is very lopsided. She also makes an ashtray.
Right,
it just looks like a whole bunch of
terrible, like a real bullwinkle ashtray.
Yeah, the ashtray looks like a whole bunch of fingers. Like,
yeah,
all around.
It's very large.
So part of me was wondering if maybe he.
So Dad had a point. It was a bad ashtray.
It is a bad ashtray.
Well, part of me was wondering if maybe he's also like, I don't know. This is also, hey, it's kind of like you can bring whatever you want to with it. Part of me was like, maybe. She's being very creative and like expressive, and her shit's kind of abstract, not intentionally so. But I wonder if part of him is just like, why can't she just make a normal? Why am I seeing this? Why is my normal housewife expressing like abstract art like desires or whatever?
Well,
like?
Yeah, I think there's definitely something about. It's. I think they do a really good job with the prop department. And you'll just be in a scene and you'll just see some weird object there. And it just feels jarring in the overall muted aesthetic of the show, of the set. And I think there is. Like, there's something symbolically like he is resistant to something that's unfamiliar or something that's, it aesthetically uncomfortable to him about it. And he's resisting it in a way that he can't really articulate. And then so he's shutting down and...
Yeah.
Refusing to engage with her, which is, you know, of course immature, but it's really fascinating to see how they express it.
It's a very deep character conflict that you wouldn't do like this on any other show in a way. Like, it's the Wonder Years way. It's very unique. I was blown away is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. the mug breaks, things get very tense, and then at dinner Kevin's like, well, I know the thing that will bond them is if they have something to yell at. So he tries to start a food fight with his brother, and Dad yells, Mom does not work.
Right, she just gets upset, walks away, leaves the table.
Yeah. Oof. I mean, like, how... the parent reactions are so emblematic of that time. Like, the dad reminds me so much of my grandfather, not so much my actual dad, which I guess makes sense in terms of, like, linear. Have any feelings about those? Any dad feelings this show brings up?
Well, I was just going to say that scene it was like a perfect example of what Dan was describing, which is like, it's such a pathetic, like when he shoots the mashed potatoes at his brother and it just nothing happened. It's so lame and just so powerless, and just watching his attempt to sort of like, come on, guys, like rouse his family, just fall completely flat. It's so devastating.
Because there's something going on here that like is bigger than you know, and even than we know, but it's just like we're not talking about it. You know, it's
right. Yeah. And when you're a kid, it's like you recognize that some fights are two people get into a tiff about something and it doesn't really matter, and it just needs to be diffused. And sometimes something like that you can diffuse with like a joke or a funny thing. And then you try to treat every situation like that. And when it doesn't work, and in this case reveals something, you know, a deeper tension between his parents that can't be so easily untangled. That's just like the perfect illustration of how little power he has in the situation.
I also noted around this time that, and I don't know if this is like a whole Wonder Years thing, but the episode is directed from low. Like, all the shots in the kitchen when Kevin is seated and looking at his parents, they are not, like, at head level of the parents. They are kind of, like, at middle. And so you're seeing everything from literally Kevin's point of view. And I don't know, I don't know if that's how every episode is shot or if that's just Daniel Stern being very smart.
Yeah, it's like they set the camera on the table where the kids are sitting for the parents.
Yeah.
Scene.
And then even, like, at the... When Kevin and Jack, I know names, are even sitting and watching the football game together. They're watching football, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they're watching a sport. They're doing sports.
It's football, Brett.
Well, it's a ball. They're doing a sports ball. Ooh,
trust me on this one. They say fourth awful. Down. That's the
table
key.
Tennis?
It's a little sports secret.
The camera seems to be like more at Kevin's eye view than the adult, which is, I don't know, emblematic, y'all.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I also loved, what was Ben Stein's, like, little, like, bingo, a hellish nightmare of bodies writhing in agony.
That's also what he says about Obamacare, though, so I don't know if that's like...
is Ben Stein canceled? Ben Stein's canceled,
Ben Stein sucks. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He probably always says...
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it, that's so weird to think about that, like, even someone, like, beloved like that nowadays, that would be, like, if, like, Sean Spicer got a role on a sitcom, he'd be like, fuck this guy. You know,
like, exactly.
Dancing with a Star. Wait, what was Ben Stein's role in the Nixon administration?
He was a speechwriter.
A speechwriter and, like, I thought advisor as well, or in some advisory capacity somewhere, but I could be wrong on that.
I'm also watching Family Ties, kind of like for the first time ever right now, because it's on CBS All Access, and I gotta use that $5
a month. Is that
worth
paying for?
If you want to watch Caroline in the City.
Okay. She's a cartoonist.
Yeah, it's on there. I don't know. The Star Trek shows are good. So if you're a Star Trek person, get them, have it for a month, and then boot it.
But they're on everything else, right? Like, except for Discovery,
The new Star Trek shows. Picard and Discovery are on there.
Oh, you guys talking about CBS All Access?
Yeah. CBS All Access sponsoring the podcast.
You can watch Tuning Out the News.
All right.
With our friend John Vershad.
I'm in AA. CBS All Access, that is.
But I'm watching Family Ties, and it is so wild to see Alex P. Keaton as this, like, Nixon-loving, arch-conservative, like, preppy, popular kid that everyone loved, and, like... I was like, it speaks to both how charismatic Michael J. Fox is, just how wonderful he is as a performer, and also how deeply fucked up the 80s were, that a child who is, like, a Nixon sympathizer is like, oh, what a scoundrel. I watched an episode where he was angry that his little, like, 3-year-old brother in preschool was learning how to share, and so he went into the preschool and rallied them against socialism. Like, no thank you, Alex.
Did Nixon's speechwriter and since canceled political agitator Ben Stein ever have a role that wasn't school teacher or school administrator?
The Clear Eyes ad.
Or game show.
Yeah, the time when he was getting his money stolen by Jimmy Kimmel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or... Jimmy Kimmel antagonist or Clear Eyes spokesperson.
Oh, my God. We're going to get that Zoom reunion at some point. Has Kimmel not done that yet? During this quarantine?
The Win Ben Stein's money.
I feel like, yeah.
Did either of you guys see the...
Is Ben Stein on Twitch, you think?
what was his intelligent design documentary called?
Ben Stein?
In the last decade, Ben Stein
hosted and self-financed. I don't know the name of it.
I think in collusion with like fucking Dinesh D'Souza or one of those fuckheads, put out some like, great. Well, why don't we teach that? You know, like it was about like.
Does he narrate it?
Yeah, it was called Monkey Eat or something like that, because it was about like, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, that we should teach.
No, also,
you know, evolution is just a theory, you know.
Ben Stein's voice, not a good narration voice. Because it's like it's a droning
joke. The one thing he's known for is being an excruciating dullard. You know?
So yeah, please let him narrate your documentary. Okay, cool.
Famously emotionless voice.
So Kevin, like when I really noticed the metaphor was when Kevin glued the mug back together, which was maybe the most obvious. The Wonder Years hitting the metaphor hard is Kevin gluing the mug back together, which is still pretty subtle compared to A Family Matters or Step by Step.
Right.
Wait, real quick. I'm sorry. I got to walk it back 1 second.
Oh, my God.
I got the Ben Stein role that he is not a teacher or administrator. He's the doctor in The Mask.
Oh. Oh, a serious part for once.
Yeah.
What episode? Ben Stein was definitely on an episode of Baywatch, right?
Probably, like, you know.
I feel like.
Wearing a bucket hat with like zinc oxide on his nose under a big umbrella, being like, you know,
I'm here to judge the bikini contest.
Well, it's no day
I'm
at
drowning.
The beach.
Help, I'm drowning.
So this is when
I can't swim.
This is when Norma comes home and she's made a vase and it's actually good, and her kids kind of have that reaction of just like, wait a second,
wow,
you're
Mom.
They're like, oh my God, this is actually good.
Yeah, no one quite says that, but that is absolutely the energy with which they react to it.
We were on Mean Dad side until right now.
Yeah.
No,
you didn't know this, but we were all dragging your crap art before this.
They do a good job of depicting that recalculation of like, okay, so we were clearly like being a little generous before. How do we meter our response here so that it's clearly like, oh, this one's good, but doesn't make us look like we were faking it the whole time?
No surprise, as I believe in the finale, it's revealed that the mom grew up to be like a chairwoman of the board.
Aww.
like a head of a Fortune 500 company or
good.
Something.
I like her.
Yeah.
I want her to be successful. You know who doesn't want her to be successful? Jack, because all he wants is fucking Pepsi. Big Pepsi bought
oh,
this
God,
episode.
The Pepsi thing. Yeah. Like that too. Like the
wait, you think they paid their way
the
into
passive aggression, like, and it like that the resolution is just the resolution to all of this is really just calm, like not even acceptance. It's just her like fucking swallowing it and not shitting it out. Like that's the magic trick. That's the resolution of this fucking episode. It's really wild. It rocked me in a way I did not expect.
Yeah.
He wants Pepsi and he's like, are you going to the store? And she's like, well, no, but I mean, I can't. Like what's like, I'm going out to like my art thing. Like there's all this like tension about like, and it all is because of Pepsi. And it boils over when he, like, gets close to the vase and she, like, lunges at it and is like, do not break it. And it's just like, oh, the layers, we are excavating issues right now. Like, and it,
yeah, it's really
get, like,
powerful.
The fight.
Well, that's the scene I was talking about, that where they most specifically do that structure of a fight where it's like, no, it's okay, I'll do it. It's like, no, yeah. I'm saying it's okay. No one is ever actively disagreeing with the other person. They're both passively, like, moving in the opposite direction. And you think paid for that spot? You think they paid for
it? They want to be associated with breaking up this marriage?
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, they say the word Pepsi a lot, but...
Was Pepsi bigger in the 60s?
No, I don't think they were doing... I don't think integration was that savvy in television at that point, even in the late 80s.
Sir, we've gotten the R&D back, and it says that Pepsi drinkers are thirsty after yelling at their wives. Are there any TV shows?
I know who our guy is. Yeah. Jack. They love this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, they all think he's the good guy. Pepsi drinkers think Jack's the good guy in this episode.
Yeah, because Pepsi drinkers hate pottery.
Yeah,
love
I remember
women
him being more specific, sympathetic in other episodes, and he's like clearly the bad guy. You kind of addressed this earlier, but he's like clearly in the wrong this whole episode, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And I honestly think I mean, I guess I'll like go chronologically, but like that final moment that Dan was talking about is almost redemptive to him, even though he's so clearly like the fact that it is less explicit is almost redemptive to him because it sort of acknowledges how repressed he is.
Yeah, it's so like they fight about Pepsi. Karen flat out calls him a male
chauvinist pig. Yeah,
like, and it's like, oh, she's going in, and then they. coughing and not editing that out. They fight so hard and they do not resolve it. Adult Kevin Daniel Stern says like dad did not get home until midnight.
Right.
And then like, so the resolution of all of it is in the next morning, mom is ironing in the kitchen. She like maybe burns her hand a little, goes over to the sink. Dad has come in. He's not talking to her. She tries to like wash, like cool off her hand, starts crying at the sink because Jack's just standing there. And then he just, and this is where I almost started crying, because it's like, he just touches her back, she starts crying harder, then she, like, turns around, they look at each other, and then, like, slowly, like, figure out each other's body language to, like, hug, and then are, like, intimate again, and then the narration says, like, I know this sounds crazy, but that was the first time I saw my parents alone together, and it's just like, oh my god.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Especially because we've also seen, you know, speaking of nostalgia triggers in the show, we've also seen 8mm no sound footage of the parents sort of like flirting and kissing each other
in their courtship days. Mm-hmm.
Well, the kids are in some of that footage, so have been a montage. I'm not sure.
The one that ends it, I wrote down who has the camera, because it's like the parents are on the swing and then it pans over to the kids at the picnic table and they're all like,
or
ew,
something.
And it's like, yeah, the aunt or something.
Right. But yeah, that moment. Okay. So there's a couple things that happen there. One is that he doesn't immediately put his hands on her back. He like lifts his hands up and hesitates. And that a moment in like an adult relationship or that feeling in an adult relationship where, because like with someone who you're intimate with, where there's been a conflict and you feel like unsure what the physical boundaries are as a result of like, and like how you're like allowed to express intimacy in that moment because of like how severe the conflict is between the two of you.
Yeah. And if like, she wants your comfort even like,
right.
It's
and that's all expressed in that like very slight gesture where he lifts his hands up, stops for a second, then she can't see it. And then he puts them on her back. I like remember thinking like, God, that's such a specific choice that illustrates so much about what his meant. Like he's acting like he doesn't care. He tells her he doesn't have time to talk about when she finally confronts him.
Yeah.
He says he doesn't have, cause there's that scene where I don't know if we skipped over that, but they're arguing in the kitchen and the kids can all hear it in the other room.
Yeah, they're in the living room. Yeah.
And he's basically evading and he's just saying, what? I don't hate pottery. He never says it. And Kevin's like, notice he didn't say he liked it. He keeps doing that. He won't say he likes it. And they're in the living room and then the dad is yelling and keeps avoiding and saying like, I know I don't have time for this. He's just angry that he's being confronted on this thing where he's clearly being sort of repressive. And I think in that moment, like, but you don't know for sure throughout if he really thinks he's right. And then I think in that moment where he hesitates, you realize that he's actually anxious, and it sort of confirms that he has sort of dug his heels in too much and doesn't know how to get out of this thing and doesn't totally know even why he feels that way, I think. And that's all in that. So that's in that moment. And then he like puts his hands on her and
It was so loaded that it's like it's a generation of men who didn't have those tools, those emotional tools, rather, to even like
don't apologize. Process.
Yeah,
don't.
Yeah. Or that, like, why would a woman was crying? Something wrong? I don't know, whatever. Yeah. Or even like I think part of it too is even like you know like the pursuit of a creative endeavor is like a ridiculous thing. Even though he like never names it, you know.
Yeah, well, even like they do say more. I think
they say at the beginning when she's like, she mentions the name of the instructor. Was it Richard or something? She says like, oh yeah, Richard thinks this, and he like grunts over, and I was like, oh, it's gonna be one of those like he's jealous of the that's not the story. Like there are so many of these like simple sitcom plots that it could go down very easily. He could have gone to the pottery class and seen her with Richard and then gotten jealous and blah, 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 like, you know, but that's not even it.
Yeah,
or it might be
more
a fraction of it.
Right.
The show never underlines like, well, you know, Norma, I was mad because of X, Y, and Z, and here's how we solved them. And I think like it makes it so much more of a gut punch because you can project so much more. It makes you think, it like gets you in your head. I was like, that's the most comforting looking hug I've seen in a while on television.
Yeah.
It was just like, oh, I want that hug.
Yeah. The moment that they actually start to hug, I like really teared up because you just see that like he's, well, that's like, that's why I said, like, I think if he had expressed himself and said, you know, I've been a bore these past three sitcom acts. And I realized there's something about myself that's going to affect my behavior until next week. And they really would have, I would have been like, well, then if he knew this the whole time, then he's totally irredeemable because he's treating his wife like shit. But like, again, I may be repeating myself, but when you see the, it's not just that like you acknowledge that he's been anxious, but also then you actually see him make the gesture and try, and like it's that she's burned her hand and he's just like trying to comfort her, and it's this very sort of root level emotion that he's expressing and that they're both experiencing, that right. Where he's trying to comfort her, and you see him actually, that's the degree to which he's capable of making an effort. It's so powerful.
When I think of like something, a show like this and how they handle a moment like that compared to, I mean, they're wildly different, but I think the closest thing you could do to like have like a time traveling melodrama thing would be something like This Is Us, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, hey, we're, you know, hey, back in when we were all growing up and that sort of thing. And the emotions here are so blunt and ungraceful, and they're treated as such because emotions are, frankly, blunt and ungraceful things.
Yeah.
And that it's not there. Any poetry in the moment is inferred after the fact by Daniel Stern's character. It doesn't make, there's no swell of music on the soundtrack or anything. It's, and even as an adult, it's like, it's from the point of view who's someone who's maybe made peace with it, but still not sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, even the ungracefulness of Jack's emotions. It's, you know, that's such a male, that generation thing of, it's not even acknowledging you fucked up. It's just like, it's broken. It's crying. Okay. I guess I'll hug it. Okay. Even though it makes better. You know, it's really, really, really juicy stuff. This was much more loaded than I expected it to be.
I think that last moment is more caring than you're describing, though. I feel like I think he's totally incapable of expressing himself, but I think that shock him.
It's an expression of,
Well, and it's also like a statement of that she accepts it, that like she doesn't want more.
Right, and it's not, right.
And it's also like that's not even like a condemnation of like her or like saying you should want better. It's like, no, like just how it was and how this relationship is he does literally the tiniest thing of just touching her back. And that is enough to like, or it's also like indicative of how close they are.
Right. Well, I think that's the other thing that's not, you know, the other running theme that's sort of thrown back to there, which is that we've seen this footage of them really intimate together on the 8mm. And we get this idea that at some point his parents were really in love. I mean, I don't know how old the older daughter is, but like I assume these people have been married for, I want to say at least 20 years, maybe 18 years.
Yeah.
And so we see them, you know, it's not just that he touched her back, but it's that gesture allows the two of them to sort of snap out of it or snap back into, like really seeing each other the way that they did when they were younger. Yeah.
And that's
like when Rogue touches someone skin to skin and like, you know, she gets all the memories. It's like he touched her back and it's just like they could just like snap back in with all the memories.
Sucked out her life force.
Yeah.
And now she will forever. He has her memories forever.
Yeah. And now she's dating a Cajun man.
Yes.
Platonically. Exactly. That's where this show made me, a weird comparison to make maybe, but like. That's where it made me think of Malcolm in the Middle. Wildly different approaches, but still that acknowledgement and sort of that like room tone of like the stuckness of a family. Mm-hmm. Of like for all of us, it's like, because where are we going? What do we do? This is it. This is life. This is our life. This is our family. And there are those moments of acknowledging that happened. I think. You know, maybe with more frequency for lower income families. I think they happen in all families. You know, I think growing up poorer is something that Malcolm in the Middle really fucking nailed.
Mm-hmm.
In a very weirdly specific way. But like, that sense of stuckness of like, as no one's running out, no one's driving into the night, no one's going to Mexico, no one's going to their sister. Those, and it makes you like, I guess they're, you know, again, life is rich and complicated, but like ultimately, like I'm running away with Maurice, the pottery teacher. Those are a Hollywood convention. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. Not to say those things don't happen in real life, but like that it doesn't go there, that it's so much more interesting to have to fucking sit in it.
Yeah.
Are y'all ready for some must have facts about this episode?
Oh, Brett, I'm so ready. These facts.
I have, yet you must have them. Here they come.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So for the season, on average, Wonder Years was watched by 16.3 million people this year. A lot of people loving those Wonder Years.
That's crazy. That's so many people.
That was only 22 out of a. It was only 22 show of the year.
Wow.
Tied with The Hogan Family and the NBC Sunday Night Movie. What a snapshot in time that was.
Imagine being the showrunners of the show that has so much heart and soul into it and like so much care and thought. And we're like, well, how are we doing in the ratings? It's like, oh, we're doing great. We're on par with a movie. It's like, which movie? Like, nah, just the concept that they show a movie.
A movie. Well,
as popular as that. Yeah.
For
Airport
this
79.
With commercials.
For this specific week of the year, the last week of January 1989, the top five shows of that week were number 5, Cheers, 4, Murder, She Wrote, 3, A Different World, 2, The Cosby Show, and number 1, Part 1 of Lonesome Dove.
Ooh. Wow. The Larry McMurtry miniseries.
Yes. But like comparing Wonder Years to the other shows, like Cheers, Murder, She Wrote, A Different World, and The Cosby Show, it is so different than anything else that's on TV at the time. It's like a half hour dramedy with no laugh track. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Also, I just thought of a joke like the one Dan did earlier. It would be like, yeah, I'm into S&M, Sunday night movie.
Oh, hell yeah. It wasn't and at all. It was the letter
no, it was
N,
and,
you
it's
see.
S&M,
you
yeah.
see. You see.
I tricked
the problem
you.
Was your ears, yeah. not my ears.
They should have made a like commemorative t-shirts to be like, hey guys, we're 22 for the season. Here are your t-shirts. I'm into S&M. Yeah. Going to Goodwill.
I should have thought of that when we were still talking about it, but
no,
it didn't, didn't occur to me.
I'll edit it back in.
Okay,
into that
yeah,
part.
If you yeah. can do yeah. a little continuity editing here, yeah. that would be great.
I'm like my whole life is like 90% like, you know, l'esprit d'escalar, like, you know, like thinking of like the thing when you're on your way out of the party. But then I run back into the party and grab everybody. I say, hey, remember 3 hours ago when we were talking about that thing? Well, how about this one, you know? Yeah.
And everyone just like lifts you up on their shoulders and is like, yeah. yes.
Yes.
the Our Tuesday king. Night. The Tuesday night ABC lineup that this aired as part of included, what a lineup, Who's the Boss, The Wonder Years, Roseanne, Anything But Love, and then closing out with 30-something.
Anything But Love? What's that?
That was the, was it Richard Lewis and Jamie Lee Curtis?
Ooh, wild.
Oh, wow.
They were both, worked at a magazine, I do believe, and like, I think it was, and they were like, will they, won't they, maybe? Lasted like 3 or 4 years, so it was kind of a thing.
Well, yeah,
she's
the
so
pure
powerful,
romantic
he's so neurotic,
charisma.
Yeah,
I was gonna say the pure romantic charisma of Richard Lewis. Of course, they got 3 or 4 seasons.
I also love that Jamie Lee Curtis was on a sitcom because, like, Jamie Lee Curtis is Jamie Lee Curtis. What
yeah,
is she
she's
doing?
A movie star. You know, yeah. like, yeah.
I guess I don't know where her career was in 1989. That you know, I don't know what the 80s were like for her, but. This was before True Lies.
Fish Called Wanda? I mean, she had a good
80s. Oh, right. Yeah. Jeez. Wow. That's huge.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll do it on some. So this episode, so the writing Emmys for this season, Wonder Years had 4 of the 5 spots. And it was this episode, Coda, Losers, and Our Mrs. White were the 4 Wonder Years episodes that were nominated. But what won was the pilot for Murphy Brown. Boom.
Wow.
Suck it, Wonder Years.
Like, had Wonder Years, I wonder if Wonder Years had like done well in the previous year or like, you know.
They got nominated for writing Emmys like every year. Like, yeah. And I don't know if they ever, I think they did win eventually.
I'd also believe them as like a perennial nominee, never winner show, yeah. you know.
But also,
buy that.
When you have 4 of the spots of the 5, you are just splitting your vote.
Yeah, yeah. It's
and
like,
so that was...
I feel like, the last one to really do that, I feel like, was, I don't know, maybe like West Wing. I feel like West Wing always had that where they were like, you know, 4 out of the 5 writing nominees were that. Breaking Bad usually like, always had like a couple, but never like 4. That's wild.
I will say that Murphy Brown pilot is pretty darn spectacular. Like, I had never watched Murphy Brown because it was too liberal. And then my friend Megan loaned me the season 1 DVD, the only DVD of that show to exist.
So you
and
had punishment too. You see, you had
yes,
punishment
yeah.
too, Brett. You were.
And when I watched the pilot of Murphy Brown, it sent me into an existential, like, I will never be able to live in this time to make a show like this at that time. And that feels like a curse. Like, watching Cheers is a loaded experience for me because I fully do feel like my dream job purpose on this earth is to be a staff writer on Cheers. And, you know, temporarily,
you
that's not going to work.
But that's just that story at that time, man. Like, you know.
So it's just wild.
There's
so,
the version of that now. And when you see it or when you write it, you'll know.
Yeah, everyone sits 6 feet apart. Otherwise, it's the same show.
Yeah. So on IMDb, 231 randos rated this episode an 8.6 out of 10. Would you all go higher or lower, or would you agree with that? I would go way higher, personally.
I give it a 9.3.
Yeah, 93.
8.6 is real strong. Why that feels good to me is because this is the only episode of this show I've seen in a real fucking long time, and you need somewhere to go. You know what I mean? Like, you need the ceiling up and down. Like, because if this hit me like this completely out of context, I can only imagine what treasures there are to discover. Maybe when I'm in a more emotionally stable place. Over. I don't know if this is the healthiest thing to dive into.
Google worst
right now,
Wonder Years episodes and just watch those.
There's six seasons. There's a lot of gems in there.
And he doesn't end up with Winnie at the end. Like, you know, there's some heartbreaks to come. But they do make out in the barn during the rainstorm to Bob Seger's We've Got Tonight.
Oh,
wow.
Man.
For someone who hasn't seen this in 25 years, you remember...
That's really in there.
Significant detail.
They're like, he has his license, and they go on a drive, and the car breaks down, and they get in a fight or something, and then they're like walking through like a field or something to a gas station, and it starts to rain, and they've been fighting, and they run, and they find like a farmhouse, and they go in the barn, and they start like smooching real hard, and it does the, we've got tonight, who needs tomorrow?
I vaguely remember it. It's funny because there are other episodes that I think burned in my, like the for me, the one where his brother signs up to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He like signs up. Yeah, as to rebel against his dad, and he and his friend. Yeah, that one ends on a moment that is absolutely devastating. And I think the pilot is another one stuck in my head, that moment in the end in the woods. And like, I think there's some episodes, you know, I'm saying you have this crystal clear memory, but I'm like, oh, no, I could do shot for shot for some of these things I haven't
seen
now, in decades.
Like, I got to say, though, so much of the show, it's even that one there, it's like these strong, recognizable licensed music things. Uh-huh. And that intro really fucking threw me. And if I got to
Bob Seger ain't in that episode.
That stopped in the last year or two. I was like, hey, I'm going to do Dawson's Creek again. And it's just not the Paula Cole song at the top. And you're like, I don't think so, man.
Yeah, this how is, dare you?
It's like, how you dare know you? What I mean?
No.
Yeah,
pay the money.
It
well,
stopped
to that point,
me. Like,
the episode where they sign up to join the army ends with Forever Young in a way that's like completely devastating if you see the end of the episode.
Alphaville Forever Young?
Rod Stewart.
Young, young.
No, the Rod Stewart version. Forever young, forever young.
Wait, can you guys sing some more versions of Forever Young?
Wait, what?
Let the wind be bad, and every light.
Yeah, but also,
see.
Both of those are 80s. Did they have 80s songs in Wonder Years?
Yeah, I think, that Seeger song is not from the fucking 60s.
Yeah, I don't think it's all period. It's like Mad Men did that too. Like where it's like
sort of
the Decemberists.
They only
there.
Did it like that one time, and I'm like, that, I don't know why, but whatever.
But like,
I would buy
a John Mellencamp song on the Wonder Years because it's like, you know, Lou did it. It's all the same.
Kevin
like still, it's all still nostalgia soup. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like in a way, like Bob Seger and John Mellencamp to me are like the musical version of a show like The Wonder Years, where it is just sort of like nostalgia.
America.
Specifically boomer nostalgia.
Boomer America. Who had the must-see performance in this episode? Hard.
Damn.
I
wanted to take that mother out of that house. I wanted to
and take her out to a nice dinner. Dan, is that what
you're
saying?
Just
get
like,
your CDs
just,
and get out of there.
I could see you two together. I think that would
no,
be
no. I just mean it. Just like you need like plane
oh,
ticket,
then that leaves the
plane
Dan
ticket
open.
And some money. It just like you got a sister you can stay with. My God,
no, it's
get
it's
out
pretty
of here.
Bad.
Get
for a
out
while.
Of here. You got like again. You got some family you can go to. You need like a fucking bus ticket. Something. Like, Jesus Christ.
I would give it. I mean, I guess I would give it to her. I guess I would give it to her. And the thing is like Jack, Norma, and Kevin. I'm kind of like
the kids were exemplary though. The kids were exemplary because it's all reaction. You know, they say acting is react. Like all those shots of them in the back of the
it's
car.
What?
Those shots in the back of the car.
Good acting.
I just did a self tape, you fuckers. Why didn't you tell me?
I could have used that cheesecake ad. Philadelphia cream cheese is going to chew me up and spit me out.
Just when, like cream cheese.
When the kids, when the big hug happens and it's just the kids at the table, like, just sort of like, we're all in this. And yeah. I wasn't the youngest, but I'm one of three. We were all boys in our family, but one of three, just that feeling of like, well, okay, we've all just, you've been at that.
We did
that. Sometimes it's just you're at your cousin's dance recital that sucks, or whatever it is. But that feeling of like, okay, we all just have to sit in this while we'll all process it. And then later outside of it, it's like, you're all brushing your teeth like, boy, that was weird earlier, right? Yeah, that was weird. Yeah. those moments,
Yeah, it feels so real.
Yeah.
All the kids are great. I mean, I feel like the mom's breakdown towards the end is just so believable, though, when she finally confronts him and she's desperate about it.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking, but it's played so well. I mean, I give a lot of credit to the dad, too, but I don't think he had to display as much emotional range throughout the episode. But there are some subtle moves there that are really impressive.
So let's split the difference. Ben Stein it is.
Ben Stein gets all of your votes.
I think what we can agree is that the must-see, the must-admire person who is redeemed in the eyes of society is Ben Stein.
Must other people see this episode of television?
This is really good. This is really good.
This is like a good intro to the series. Also, if you haven't seen it,
it fucking caught me off guard. How good it was. I've been watching a lot of Step by Step lately, which is also a classic ABC sitcom on Hulu.
Step by Step is some garbage.
Step by Step, exceedingly horny and extremely horny.
Extremely horny. That is literally
an article
in front
of the kids all the time.
I wrote that down to pitch.
Step by Step is the horniest
audience.
Dude.
The audience just wants to see all the characters make out or
and they're
fuck.
Being horny with each other. And then they play up at the fact, oh my God, it's very
weird. I also wrote down a pitch once Step by Step is the 90s pop culture wasteland because they just rode all when it's surfers are popular, here's Cody. Beavis and Butthead are popular, here are two guys literally just doing Beavis and Butthead. They just kept doing here. Kickboxers
there was an arc on the show where JT and Cody just get a show called JT's World, and it's just fucking Wayne's World. And they're the exact same arc of the movie.
Yeah.
It gets developed, and then it's phony, and it's
So have you not seen the Beavis and Butthead guys yet?
You're just no, I haven't, I'm at the end of season two, but again, they're 30 episode seasons.
So I think they're in three or four. They're in multiple episodes, which is what is the real egregious thing. I can forgive you doing a blatant Beavis and Butthead cosplay and passing it off as your own jokes once.
Yeah.
But twice.
the Wayne's World thing really threw me for a loop. Regardless, the reason I think contextually was Wonder Years. And I knew it was probably a little more of a sensitive Forrest Gumpy thing, but there's something about all right, pull it up on Hulu. It's got the ABC roll before it. And what would you do if you sang out of tune? Okay. And then just, it kind of leveled me in a way, man.
Yeah. I don't think I can add this to my rotation because it's too much.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
I need to stick with Get Smart and I Dream of Jeannie, which is what I'm also watching right now. that I bought in iTunes because that shit ain't streaming.
What's the Get Smart isn't on anything?
Nope.
That sucks.
A while ago, the entire series was on sale for $20, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I just bought it because that's very cheap for many episodes."
Say I highly recommend this show, but I also, if you are listening to this and it's currently in quarantine, my standards for hang on 1 second. My standards for what to watch right now are very different in that I'm sort of looking to for sort of. Audio visual balm at the moment is sort of my goal. Whereas usually I'm looking to be stimulated emotionally and intellectually by my entertainment choices. Right now I'm looking for something that's a little bit more soothing, I would say.
Yeah. For a couple of weeks, I just watched nothing but The Circle and literally every international version of The Circle because I could only watch what I was living.
That just sounds stressful to me.
It just felt comforting to be these people are doing the same thing I am and they're having a good time.
A very big centering thing for me during the weeks has been I wake up, I get up pretty early still because it's like I got to keep – my first or second week into this shit, I did like a day or two of like the, hey, stay up till the sun comes up and then sleep till three. Like I did a day or two of it and I was like, hey, this is fucked up. And I'm like, I know this feeling. It makes me feel bad. And so I'm pretty sticking to my rigid like work. I also am like just like working, this whole time too. I get up and I get up at like 6:45 and I make my coffee and I watch the Today Show. And I put on the Today Show and I watch like all 3 hours. I just keep it on because like I like joke drops start to be doing that sort of thing. It's just good. Like, all right, this is what's happening. This is what's out there. It makes me, it like grounds me in a way. Starting the day with the Today Show has been a real like.
Wow.
And then they also still do the third act. Like we're making quesadillas with the kids. Like, you know what I mean? It still does all
home.
That stuff. Right. that's a real a balming watch for me right now.
Yeah, mine is just watching a rotation of... I'm watching the entire 1966 Fall TV lineup. Well, not the entire, but... I've gone insane and made a spreadsheet with about 1,400 episodes of television in it.
Yeah.
From across 50 years of TV, and I've arranged them all... I've sorted them all in order of date, so I have them all in air date order, and so I am watching about 5 or 6 shows in order of how they aired in 1966.
Well, so you have
television lineup that you're kind of watching in real time.
Yeah. Wow. And it's interesting because you see these parallels. Like Paul Dooley was in an episode of Get Smart, and then the next week he was in an episode of Bewitched. And that's like really like you only realize those things if you're doing this insane thing I'm doing where you're like, oh, Paul Dooley like was having a good booking week. Like
hey, or if you were alive at the time.
Paul Dooley, bring it back to Daniel Stern. I'll also make a hard recommend if you're intrigued by Daniel Stern knocked it out of the park directing this narrator for the episode. He's also in one of my favorite movies of all time, Breaking Away. It's a movie from 1979 about a bunch of kids in a townies in a college town. It's a good, sensitive, lovely movie. It's a little young Daniel Stern, young Dennis Quaid, young Jack Earl Haley, and Paul.
Ooh.
And one of the characters' parents are Paul Dooley and Barbara Barry as a couple.
Oh.
Very fun. Movie's called Breaking Away. It's from late 79. It's fucking lovely. It's so wonderful.
This is the cycling movie?
Yeah, the cycling movie.
Yes, okay. I do remember this. And
movie's
but they're like
excellent.
Kind of a... They like live in a small town, and there's like a rivalry between like
they're all lower class, and so all the kids who go to the college, all the rich kids at the college,
right.
But it's not like a comedy. It's not like Porky's or nothing.
No,
it's like,
no,
it's like the rich kids at the college though are like, yeah, you fucking, they call them cutters because they're like
cutters,
the stone cutter kids and that sort of thing. But also like the aspiration of them all because they're all like 19 or whatever to like, it'd be nice to go to college. It'd be nice to get out of here. And that sort of, it's really lovely, really well done.
Yeah.
Hard screaming wreck with Daniel Stern in it.
Hot wrecks. Well, thank you all so much for coming on the show. Where can people find y'all on the internet to talk to you about Daniel Stern oeuvre?
Yeah, you can tweet about Daniel Stern at Nat Towson on Twitter and Instagram at Nat Towson. I'm Nat Towson on everything. I'm the only Nat Towson on the internet. Find me.
Heyo.
Short last name people. I'm so jealous. Chamberlain, so ungainly.
Dan my great-grandfather changed the spelling of my last name, too, so it's very uncommon. So SEO... He did some great late 1800s SEO.
Was it Townsend?
It was Towson with an O at the end, and now it has an E, which is drastically less common. So get all my usernames.
That's good.
Great grandpappy.
I am AMFMPM on Twitter, and because I was late to the game, I'm AMFMPMX on Instagram.
Getting it done.
Yeah.
And
do you think it was an admirer? Sorry.
No. So like my Twitter handle is AMFMPM because it used to be I used to have like a music blog. Like a Hype Machine MP3 blog that was called AMFMPM. So all my handles for all my social stuff were that. And then that was just the Twitter one just had the most followers. So I was like, I guess I'll keep it. Like, I nuked the music blog's like way forever gone, but like.
Forever gone.
Forever gone. The other version. With you.
Well, the Alphaville one is the like. Yeah. Forever young.
Forgone. You wanna I want to be forever.
I think that's
young.
The one I was thinking of.
Yeah, do probably. You really want
oh
to live
God.
Forever?
And forever. That does it for this episode of Must Have Seen TV. Thanks again to my guest Dan Chamberlain and Ned Talzin for dropping by talking about the Wonder Years with me. Next time I'll be discussing something. I don't know what it's going to be. I'll find out and then I'll let you know some way, somehow. Until then, I want to hear from all of you. Follow him at Must Have Seen TV on Twitter and Instagram, and let's talk about sitcoms. And follow the Instagram, because that's where I'm going to be live streaming sitcoms via Insta stories on my old television. Very illegal, very pirate. Don't tell Mark Zuckerberg. Also, give me your email. What? That's making a finger.
Proselytize.
If you like what you've heard, rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Brett White. Read the words that are at decider.com. Thanks to Acast for hosting the show. Thanks to y'all for listening. And just like stay safe and saner than I am right now. Woohoo! I'm sorry, that might have been offensive. And I'll see you next time on Must Have Seen TV.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.